Hello and welcome to the second episode of the Nations of Charlemagne series. Today we'll be talking about the origins of the Germans, their language, mythos, ethnos, their early interaction with the Romans, through to the emergence of the Goths, the companion episode to last week's discussion on the Gauls, before we move on to the Great Migrations next week. I am very lucky to be joined by Columba
Hello, everyone.
and by returning guest from last week, Marcus Pertinax.
Greetings, everyone.
Wonderful both to have you on here. We'll start this discussion, if that's all right, by going through the etymology of Germany, Germania, Germania. I'll go over it a bit, and if anyone wants to contribute, please do so. So from my understanding, Germani is a Latin word, but its actual origin, its actual etymology is Celtic, and they're I think there are three schools, but one has been sort of largely discredited. So we'll talk about two schools. Ger meaning deriving from ger, the Celtic word ger, meaning neighbor. So this is a Celtic word referring to the various tribes of what would later become Germania Superior and Germania Inferior. So the Nervii and the Treveri. Another etymology from it, which comes from Jacob Grimm of Grimm's brother of Brothers Grimm fame, is Gerim. Or Germ, which means battle cry. Do either of you sort of favor any of those interpretations?
The battle cry one's interesting because I mean it lines up with I think Tacitus tells us that that's how the Germans decided their battles. The battle cry was very important. They would hold their shields up in front of their faces before a battle, and they would all shout and scream. And this was so important to them that sometimes if they didn't sound quite right, there was some fear coming through them, they would just call off the battle right there. It was a sort of I guess an omen, if you will, or just a way of getting the feel of the men. So I don't know, perhaps. I mean, the explanation that I'm most familiar for in terms of the usage of the language does come from Tacitus, which I'm sure we'll get to.
Yes, absolutely. Of course, the etymology of the Germans is quite difficult, especially considering in modern day usage, so many different languages have so many different ways of referring to the Germans. So we have the word Germany, as we as mentioned, it's Celtic Celtic form, which is repurposed into Latin. If anyone wants to know where the origin of the word Deutsch comes from, it itself is comes from a earlier medieval German word. Deutsch, which itself is a reconstruction of Soizkatz, which it kind of means the people of the tribe, or the again another sort of root word of this is the German word which comes into English as diet, meaning assembly or grouping. So
Oh,
Deutsch, literally,
yeah.
sort of the etymology of it is of the people. However, the actual sort of root of that language is much later than Germany. It comes around in the ninth, the 8th and the 9th century. Another etymology for the Germans are the, of course, the Teutones, the Teutons, the Teutonic peoples, which invariably has fallen back into favor and fallen out of favor. It was very much sort of reintroduced in the medieval eras, and of course the etymology of the Teutons comes from the Teutones tribe, which together with the Kimbrians will invade the Roman Empire in the late 2nd century BC. Of course, the other definition for the Germans is the Alemanni. For people who don't know, first of all, we have the Suabians, who are sort of the main sort of confederation of German tribes we encounter in the Gallic Wars. And they would later become in the 3rd century AD the Alemanni, and of course that tribal confederation in Swabia and Alsace, which is mentioned by Cassius Dio, will then later become the French word for Germany, Allemagne. In terms of the rough sort of designation of the actual territory of Germania, we have here up for you a map which is roughly the Roman interpretation of
Yeah.
Germania. Of course, this is Tacitus writing, so this is after the Gallic Wars, even though, as we'll mention, there were Germans on the west bank of the Rhine as well, and there was some
Yeah.
interaction with the Rhaetians, which is this area below the Danube, what we consider to be Bavaria here. So his rough description of Germania is basically the lands beyond the Rhine and the Danube, and as far as they extend, they extend up into the Carpathian Mountains in Ukraine, even though there's some dispute over tribes such as the Bastarnae to be, because again, their own sort of roots that are very complicated. Some consider them to be, you know, Celtic, you know, Scythian, or
there's a lot of debate, especially when you get to like Attila and that period, because it's very once you head out northeast, you know, past you know what's now Poland, etc. Going up north, things get very messy. There's been a lot of debate, for example, around the etymology of Attila's name itself. You know, whether it's Turkic or Germanic, etc. So yeah, it gets kind of messy once you go to Eastern Europe. But the two main boundaries are the Danube and the Rhine.
Yes, and of course the northern boundary characterized here as the Vistula, even though I think it's important to note that the Romans, other than being aware of the amber trade, which was going on throughout the Baltic Sea at this point, the Romans would have had virtually no contact with any sort of tribes beyond the Vistula. That was very much the periphery of the known world at that point. Of course, in the east, north of Crimea, they would have interaction with the Scythians, who would later become, you know, the Sarmatians, Roxolani, then the Huns. But I think very much the Vistula represents the sort of the end point of Roman knowledge of the Germans. So it's very hard to sort of characterize, because again, unlike Gaul towards the end, there wasn't some sort of concrete geography or an established people. They were never able to temporarily unite as the Gauls were. In the face of the Romans, even though with Arminius we have a semblance of unification. So this and also I think it's important to note that we'll come in later when it comes to the language, that all these people aren't necessarily the same in terms of a unified culture. So moving on from the etymology, unless anyone has anything to say.
Did we cover the quote from Tacitus in which he describes that the name Germany, it comes from tribes who crossed the Rhine and then drove out the Gauls? Like, because that's a very explicit thing to cover there, right?
Yes. I mentioned that at the beginning. That's where Ger comes from, which is referring to the Nervii and the Treveri, who were tribes that settled on the west side of the Rhine. You're bordering the what later become the Roman provinces of Belgica. So yes, I did introduce that right at the beginning.
Forgive me, it's been a long one.
if that's all right. So now to the prehistory, the chronology, and then the culture of this of these peoples. As we mentioned last time, with Gallic culture, we have the distinguishing into the Hallstatt culture and the Latin culture. At the same time, we have, even though there isn't necessarily a complete break between the Hallstatt culture, you know, elements of the Hallstatt culture, especially in Austria and Upper Germany. And when I mean Upper Germany, I mean Upper Rhine. So I mean Bavaria, Swabia, were very much influenced by Hallstatt culture. In the north of Germany, so modern day Lower Saxony, Brandenburg, Mecklenburg-Vorpommern, Holstein, also parts of Scandinavia, so Scania in Sweden and Jutland in Denmark, would have comprised something called the Urnfield culture, which roughly corresponds to about the 14th century BC to the 8th century BC, which again sort of coincides with Hallstatt culture.
And we can also we can detect in a lot of the material culture here the same preoccupations that we see later. I mean, Caesar tells us that the German religion, the German religious life, was much more animistic than that of the Gauls. They worshipped, you know, the fire god, the sun, the moon, and things like this. And so we see in the early, even back to the Bronze Age cultures, and the famous Danish Bronze Age deposits, you have artworks that have been found, like the Trondheim sun chariot, which I think was found in modern day Denmark. And you see it has two metal horses at the front, and then a sort of disc with a sun in gold foil. And so this, of course, demonstrates the German and stretching back further, the Indo-European or Aryan obsession with horses, but also belief in, you know, a chariot of the sun, and the importance of chariot warfare and things like this. And so, yeah, we can see this stuff going back a very, very long way, thousands of years before the Romans were writing.
Yes, absolutely. And that's quite a nice point to get onto their rich material culture. So as we mentioned last time, when we have the Gallic settlements, you know, the foundation is the oppida and the hill fort, very similar to the Gauls, even though on a much reduced scale. We have the fortified hill forts and the walled settlements. We also, you know, they're burial culture is also quite interesting. We have German barrows, and we have the cremation pits, which are, you know, the eponymous urn fields, which gives, you know, the name to this archaeological period. And like you mentioned, the booty hoards. One thing I was quite interested, you mentioned the solar god, and you mentioned the rich Bronze Age culture. Let me just get this picture up, because here we are. This is the Berlin hat, which comes from the 13th century.
Oh yes, I've seen this.
BC. Yeah. And this is really quite fascinating, because other such hats, such as the Schifferstadt hat, these immense pointed headdresses, which, you know, considering these things are about 3,000 years old, you know, they're incredibly ornate for their time. On one purpose of these headdresses, of course, was to act as an insignia of the sun god for certain high priests to adorn themselves, certain kings. But interestingly enough, you see these markings. I'm not quite sure how this was done, but apparently these also doubled up to some form of lunar calendar, which the Germans were able to tell time. So very interesting little archaeological finds. And again, you know, something which I would almost say is unique. You know, I don't think I've ever seen something quite like this before.
I mean, the only thing that's comparable that comes to mind is you see in certain African tribal celebrations, they have these fantastic headdresses. I mean, there's some very good ones in the British Museum. I think they might come from Congo, although don't quote me on that. But yeah, I mean, it is really fascinating. I wonder how heavy it would have been, because I can't imagine it's something they would wear all the time. It's for ritual use, you know.
Yes, I can't imagine people standing up and wearing this. I can imagine, you know, someone on a throne, you know, very much sort of precariously balancing.
I mean, if we believe the stories that were told about the physical qualities of the Germans in this period, who knows?
But nevertheless, you know, the sources you're mentioning, nevertheless, are, you know, 1,000 years after this period, so we sadly really have no way of knowing this sort of the sort of people, you know, because again, they left no written culture, which is
I don't know. I think you can use typology and things like this and draw comparisons. I mean, you have no conclusive proof in terms of language, but you can make some pretty educated guesses.
Oh, absolutely. Otherwise, you know, archaeologists would be out of a job.
Yes,
and, you know, just to mention that, you know, I am no archaeologist, so I won't be able to comment that much on their, you know, wonderfully advanced research techniques. So, you know, moving on, just introducing you to a bit of the Bronze Age culture of Germania. Now we move on a couple of centuries to display the Germanic migrations. So from about the 8th century onwards, BC, as we mentioned, we have the end of the Urnfield culture and the beginning of migrations from Scandinavia into Low Germany. And this, as you know, we mentioned, would expand into modern day Poland, Bohemia, and, you know, regions across the Rhine, of course, and Swabia, and as far east as Ukraine. You know, in contrast to the Latin culture, we mentioned that it's much more southerly. As you can see from the map here, again, that originated in Switzerland. The dark red area and the orange areas roughly correspond to modern day, you know, Mecklenburg, Lower Saxony, Holstein, Brandenburg.
And I would note that the red area, the bright red area that you're talking about, that you're describing, this is the exact area where we see very early, very ornate items like the Trondheim sun chariot and items like that. And it's really interesting because I believe Snorri Sturluson, one of the saga writers in the Middle Ages, he describes, I believe it's him, he gives a sort of an etiology of Odin as it being a sort of an actual king who had been deified. And I'm pretty sure he describes the home of the Aesir as being around here as well. And so you do kind of get this impression that Germanic culture in a way emanated from this area, or it was very important site of cultural diffusion, we might say.
Absolutely. And this geographic scope which we're referring to, this area of the what would later become known as the Jastorf culture, which would roughly correspond between the 7th and the 2nd centuries BC, so really before we arrive to the Roman interactions with the Kimbrians, this area is referred to as the original homeland, or the Heimat of the German language. So you know, for anyone who's sort of interested, Jacob Grimm, who we've already mentioned, one of the elder brother of the brothers Grimm, notes the first Germanic sound shift, which, you know, he would call Grimm's Law, which is, you know, found in his book on German grammar. And this would later be developed by Karl Werner, into a Dane, into Werner's Law. And this categorizes the distinct beginnings of the Proto-Germanic language, because again, we're not arriving at German, this is Proto-German. But its use of consonants and fricatives, you know, is very much distinctive from, again, we were referring to the proliferation of Indo-European languages and how the Brythonic languages and the Gallic languages come from the same root. Here we have in the Jastorf area, we have the emergence of a distinct Germanic language as opposed to those Celtic languages, which, again, we have the first grouping. So this really takes place between the 7th and the 2nd centuries BC. I think it's important to note that, again, from our understanding of Proto-Germanic, this is the representative of some forms of the Germanic language. So from here, we have the beginning of, you know, North Germanic, West Germanic, and East Germanic language groups. The Goths, who we're going to talk about later, are very much of the Eastern Germanic type. You know, the North Germanic, we're talking about the Scandinavian peoples. West Germanic, we're talking about the Germans, the Austrians, the Dutch, and the English groups. This is, you know, became typified in the medieval era as the Theodiscus. This ancient language group, which again we know from the interactions with the church at this time. Sadly, you know, what we know from this period in terms of the actual language itself, most of it is modern reconstruction. We have actual very little knowledge of the actual language they would have spoken. So again, much of this is 19th century reconstruction and trying to understand how this language was formed. And unlike Gallic, as we mentioned last time, which was, you know, commonly inscribed into Greek, you know, very much the Gauls were able to trade consistently with the Greeks, owing again to their geographic position, which was much closer. So we're talking, you know, around the Danube and in Gaul, you know, trading from Marseille. The Germanic, the Proto-German language, didn't have a form of inscription until the Elder Futhark, or the old runic alphabets, which really don't appear until the 2nd century AD. So, you know, long after the Gallic Wars, once we, you know, just before the crisis of the 3rd century, when we get to the Romanic Wars.
Unless you believe in the assertions of certain crazy fascists who look at, you know, Etruscan stuff from like the 7th century BC and call it runes, which is a bit of a stretch. But
Well, I mean, it's a sort of commonly sort of understood that the runic alphabet isn't novel, that it is derived from the interactions with Latin and the Roman culture. Yeah. And you can sort of see it. There is a very sort of a close comparison. I'll get up a
And you see similar iconography, like the swastika and things like this.
Actually, I am just on the, you mentioned a term that I wanted to pick up on just before. You mentioned the phrase Theodiscus, was it?
Yeah.
Theodiscus, in Latin languages, so I'm saying this from the Italian perspective because I'm half like half fluent in Italian. For Latin speakers, they actually have a different word for the Germans and like the people and things which are German and the country, right? So in Italian, they would call Germany as in Germania, which is obviously derivative of the Latin Germania. But Italians and Spanish and many other Latin countries actually refer to German things as Tedeschi.
No, and Tedeschi
is derivative of the term Theodoscius, because it essentially enters into Latin languages via ecclesiastical Latin.
Yeah. Oh, I see. That's interesting.
That's fascinating. No, thank you. Thank you very much for that.
Sorry about that. I know that was a bit of a tangent, but I thought it was important.
No. It's all relevant.
We love tangents here. Don't worry.
Yes, we were talking about the various etymologies. So, Theodiski. So, again, another etymology to throw in there for the Germans.
Ecclesiastical Latin.
So, yes, it is important to understand that again, for people, that there is a differentiation between classical Latin and, again, you know, ecclesiastical Latin, and indeed, you know, modern reconstructed Latin, which is very much used in scientific language. So, moving on from that, I think it's just important to understand, you know, in terms of the runes, very much it's derived from interactions with the Latin alphabet. So it's italic, and ultimately its form. And in terms of like the proliferation of these runes, we know from, you know, the proliferation of these runes sort of goes up in various manuscripts and even sort of legal codes all the way up until the 1300s. So, you know, these would exist for about 1,000 years, this form of runic writing. And of course, they would be most popular exemplified by the Vikings. So our knowledge of, you know, most of German society comes mainly from Roman sources and indeed by medieval sources that will come later. And we do have quite extensive amount of Gothic archaeology. And in terms of the language, we'll talk about the Gothic language towards the end. But, you know, principally, we are learning about the Germans from, sorry, there's a problem on my computer. Sorry, I just need to turn off. Hello. Sorry, there'll be a bit of rumbling. I'll try and speak over it. But so moving on from that, does anyone want to talk about the famous book by Tacitus on the origins and situations of the Germans or Germania?
Well, I mean, Tacitus makes a lot of very bold assertions in the Germania. I mean, this is where the if you look at a lot of the 19th century and early 20th century literature on Germany, you know, a lot of the stuff that later on was taken up by the National Socialists and what have you. There is this idea that the Germans are sort of a pure race in the purest sense of that term. You know, they've had no intermixture with other peoples, or at least, you know, the 19th century scholars weren't arguing that that was the case. Now they acknowledged that there was lots of admixture now, but their argument was, in the earlier period, in the ancient period, when Tacitus was writing, the Germans were pure and untainted. You know, they all had blonde hair and things like this, and they were untainted by foreign blood. And of course, it doesn't take a lot of thinking to understand how that assertion and then the awareness of the mixture in the 19th century and the difference between the ancient and the modern period resulted in a lot of Nazi policy and things like this. But Tacitus tells us that the Germans were in his opinion unmixed and unique and autochthonous, so like, you know, from the area, they hadn't migrated there. I mean, that was a common belief in the ancient world. The Athenians, were of that opinion, that the first Athenians had sprung from the ground or a tree or something. This is the view that Tacitus takes, and his evidence for this, he talks about the uniform appearance of the Germans. They all have red or blonde hair, piercing eyes, and giant frames, you know. And so to him, they seemed extremely, extremely homogenous. Of course, we know that the ethnogenesis was a result of Western hunter-gatherers and agricultural peoples being conquered by, the Indo-European, charioteering peoples who came from the steppe to the east. So there is a mix there. But in terms of perhaps, you know, the Germans had been so you have these migrations which happen, you know, third millennium BC. But of course, the Germans then formed as a people. We have German language ancestors of the German language. And so you can make this argument that they were very contained from a certain point until, you know, by the time you got to Tacitus, you could make this argument that they were homogenous. But yeah, it's a very important point that Tacitus makes and has had a lot of consequences.
Yes, well, I think it's important to note that in various, you know, forms of history, it's important to categorize. Tacitus's history is ethnogonic or a theogony, and by that it's very much trying to understand the Germans from a collective sort of mythic standpoint. So in his history, he divides the Germans into three branches: the Ingovenes, the Ermiones, and the Istevones. And as far as I'm aware, these are the sons of Manus, who is in turn the son of Tisto, who is supposed to be the primeval progenitor of the German people, similar to that of Ymir in Norse mythology. In terms of like groupings, this would be the standard grouping in the Roman world until Pliny the Elder would add the Vandals and the Bastinae to that, even though, as we mentioned, the Bastinae in particular is quite a controversial grouping. So, you know, very much he does advocate some sort of, again, some sort of mythic history to the German people. And again, that's mostly been refuted by modern archaeology, which, again, you talk about the earlier migrations and then again the migrations from Scandinavia down to intermingle with you know, the Urnfield cultures and the Hallstatt cultures, which creates the Asdorf cultures. In terms of the government itself, Tacitus describes really quite a, you know, a meritocratic and egalitarian situation. Even though, you know, Caesar is points out in his commentaries on the Gallic Wars that there is no Druid class, I think it's important to understand that there is a priestly class in German society, especially a female priestly class, and that women were given a very high place of respect in German society, and marriage was typically monogamous, and the Romans thought again this was a sign of some form of, you know, moral integrity. In terms of like the organization of the Germans, we have the beginnings of these assembly of freemen. In terms of the origin of the word, this is where the word thing comes from. Thing is a assembly which, you know, in English would evolve into a moot or a hustings, which, you know, of course, we all probably know from the political assembly before the election of a constituency candidate. And, you know, in German, this evolves into, as we mentioned, through the word Deutsche, we have the word Diet, which again is a form of assembly. And again, I think this is this interesting idea where sovereignty in the German world sort of rests with the Volk. You know, even when we have the development of Germanic kingship later in the German history. So, you know, Germanic kings, you know, we have various sort of tribal leaders such as Ariovistus of the Suebi and Boiorix of the Kimbrians and Tutabad of the Teutons. But these, you know, were very much, you know, Caesar would describe them as magistrates with authority similar to that of a Roman dictator. But in terms of an actual king, or in Gothic, the word is Rex, you tended to have the fusion of, you know, a military leader, a high priest, and typically, as we'll see, this would later evolve through the Holy Roman Empire. And, you know, many of the kingdoms throughout Europe after the migrations is that all of these, you know, kingships were elected. Really, we see from the emergence of the thing, this local assembly of freemen, we have the development into quite a complex political structure.
Yeah, I mean, and that's a important point. You mentioned the sort of egalitarian structure of the society, and it's interesting. Tacitus tells us that even the slaves or the servants were treated, you know, somewhat well. They could have their own house and they would tend the crops, and in a way they were sort of like a peasant or a serf, you know. From what I can tell, the idea of chattel slavery or on the scale of the Greeks or the Romans was unknown to them. But far less common. Towering preoccupation that you always see when you're studying the ancient Germans is their preoccupation with freedom. You know, I mean, Caesar tells us that they couldn't bear to sort of live next to each other, and Tacitus corroborates this. You know, and there is a. You must make a differentiation culturally, I suppose, and the archaeology bears this up, between the southern provinces or the southern areas of Germania, which have much more intercourse with the classical culture, and of course you can argue that the Romanization is just a political emanation of a process that's been going on for a long time of infrastructure and influence and diffusion from the civilized south. So there's definitely an argument there, but. This is backed up by the archaeology. You know, you see farms and a lot of agriculture in the south along the Danube and the Rhine, around that area. But once you go up north, it gets more and more scant, and there was more and more forest. I mean, we had the gigantic Hercynian forest, you know, which ran through most of Germany. I mean, I believe the Black Forest is a sort of remnant of it. But the people could barely stand. Living next to each other. There's not any evidence of very large urbanization. I mean, there's evidence of, you know, sort of hill forts, maybe 10,000 people maximum. Yeah. Although they're very rare. Many of the peoples in the far north are described as using bone by Tacitus, and you know, wearing furs and barely wearing any clothes. And so we get the idea that some of these peoples were really primitive technologically, at least, but they did have a capacity for collective decision making, You mentioned the Confederation of the Suevi. In the last stream, we talked about the land of the Carnutes and how it was sort of held as a sacred sort of place. Well, within the Confederation of the Suevi, there was a tribe called the Semnones, and they had a similar situation where all of the tribes from the Confederation and some other tribes would come and make offerings to the gods at their special shrine, which was a sort of protector of the people. Tacitus actually tells us that if you fell over in the shrine, you couldn't stand back up because the god had humbled you. And so if you wanted to leave the shrine, you had to roll out, which I think is a pretty wonderful, wonderful image. But
Has a rather pragmatic streak to it, doesn't it?
Well, I quite like it.
Like insofar, even if you're a servant or you're a prince, so like Arminius, it doesn't matter what standing you are in society, if you fall in the temple, you roll out like any other man. There's kind of like a strange egalitarianism to it, you know?
There's a lot of this. I can't remember if Tacitus says it, but I'm pretty sure in a lot of cases, sentences of murder were restricted to the priests. They were the only ones who could execute, but maybe I'm getting confused. But you do see that it was a culture that valued individuality and freedom. But there was a strong tribal sense. But very different from the civilized South.
And it's interesting you say that, Columba, because from what the Romans observed in their attempt to annex Germania, you know, with the campaigns of Drusus and Tiberius, and then obviously with the retaliatory campaigns of Germanicus to follow, the Romans come across several of these sort of hamlets that would barely even qualify as villages that don't have more than 50 or 100 people, and they're scattered all throughout the what the Germans would call the Wald, you know, all through the forest. Between the Rhine and the Elbe, there'd be dozens of these little communities, and they'd be, you know, however far apart, you know, they might be a given frequency from each other, but They wouldn't be densely populated. And a part of that sort of rejection of urbanism, and a rejection of urbanism that is greater than what the Gauls even would demonstrate that, yeah, for them an individual sovereignty was an important thing, but not in like some sort of Lulbert kind of way, but in a very sort of earthly kind of visceral tied to their natural world sense.
Yeah.
They very much embrace that, and it's something I think even astonishes the Romans, to be honest with you.
And I think this goes a long way, this sort of not a strong attachment to the land. I mean, Caesar tells us that they would change their land pretty often, you know, every year in some places. They would all get up and move somewhere else and reapportion land and settle scores, etc. And you must understand this when you look at the massive migrations that we talk about, you know. These people were remarkably able to just pick up sticks. And of course, you do see a similar situation with the Gauls, but with the Germans, it seems to be even more intense and disorganized and still nothing's settled. It's just a brew of peoples in some places, and they're all moving around. So there is a lot of variety within Germania, and I think that's important for people to get. They're not just all barbarians running around naked.
Well, just before we end this topic on sort of sovereignty and this little tangent we've indulged ourselves on, you think you just reflect momentarily on the fate of Arminius, you know, the great hero of the German tribes that, you know, vanquishes Varus and his three legions in the Tetute Burgerwald. He basically becomes too big for his boots, and even after getting the better of the is it the Marcomanni he ends up defeating after his squabble with Germanicus, he is slain, and he's slain by his fellow Cherusci. He's slain by his fellow kinsmen because they believe he's simply accumulated too much power, and he starts to act in a kingly fashion, which is un-German to them. It's not their way.
Yeah, we might argue that. I don't know. Are we getting ahead of ourselves, AM? Do we want to say?
We are getting a bit ahead of ourselves.
Sorry, mate.
But nevertheless, you know, it is. We are making sort of these broad generalizations before we get into chronology. So if you want to sort of bring up specific examples, please do so. But yes, but we will be revisiting Arminius. There's been a little war raging in the chat, and I want to put a stop to this. The Magyars and the Huns are not the same people. Okay. Moving on.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
All right. Now, I'd like to talk about the mythology, if that's all right. You know, moving on from that topic on the conception of Germania, which is very interesting. Thank you both very much for those contributions. We already have, you know, similarities with the Celts, even though, as we mentioned, there are, you know, major distinctions. So we have, you know, human sacrifices, we have divination, we have animism. you know, in particular, Tacitus says that the Suebi would sacrifice Roman prisoners of war. In the Gallic Wars, though, as you mentioned, Columba, Caesar would refer to the German belief system as primitive compared to the intricate customs of the Gauls. As you mentioned, you know, they had no druids and they would only worship the elemental forces of, you know, the sun and the moon. Ironically, he's correct, but referring to a much older incarnation of the Germans, because, you know, this is contradicted really by everything that Tacitus refers to. For example, Tacitus would look into the esteemed role for the German seeresses, who, you know, played very interesting roles, kind of similar to that of the Druids, in terms of, you know, both instigating rebellions against the Rome, such as we have one by name, the Seeress Veleda, during the Batavian Rebellion of 69, and acting as tribal envoys, but also as agents of human sacrifice. On the one hand, you have the seeresses, you know, garrotting and sort of cutting the throats of Roman prisoners of war. But there's something I'll get into quite later, which is the German interest in drowning human sacrifices in the bog, which is something I'll elaborate on later. But in terms of, you know, again, elaborating on this this particular order of the seeresses, they had a particular association with the goddess of youth and beauty, Freya. I guess if there's going to be a Greco-Roman equivalent, that would be Aphrodite, Venus. In terms of like other sort of embodiments of the seers, you know, what was really represented by a seer? Tacitus mentions another seer by the name of Albruna. You know, the etymology of that is possessor of the secret wisdom of the elves. And this, again, is quite interesting in terms of where we get to almost, you know, high fantasy, you know, arriving from Proto-Germanic mythology. Yeah. Elves, you know, basically the association with the word elf is similar to that of sort of white. They play, you know, a prominent role in Germanic and Norse mythology. They are believed to be, you know, possessors of supernatural beauty, you know, possessed of magical powers, also have a general ambivalence towards men. And, you know, are basically portrayed in terms of like bringing, you know, either seducing men or being the harbingers of illness.
We do see parallels, right, with fairies and such.
Oh yes, fairies, of course, being the derivative in Irish mythology, which is where we get the cut. I'll just bring up another picture here. Give me a second. Right here. So yes, it's
Oh, I love that painting.
Yes. So and again, we see this in the modern sort of reincarnation of or sort of reformulation of German mythology. So, for example, you could very much ascribe these characteristics to the Rhine maidens in Wagner's Ring of the Nibelung. Very interestingly, in terms of the characteristics of the elves, these pesky little creatures who can essentially help or hinder people who come across them. In terms of sort of Christology, there is an assumption that the idea of an elf was later appropriated into the Christian concept of a demon, which is quite interesting.
There's a lot of that.
Yes, a lot of appropriation. Mm. In terms of like the general deities that were worshipped, of course, we have Wotan, who, you know, in Anglo-Saxon would be Wodan. And of course, in Norse, Odin, you know, the characteristic king of the gods with his
spear. The Romans usually refer to him as Mercury, right?
The Caesar refers to Mercury as having a particular significance to, I can't remember whether it was Canones was the Gaelic equivalent of, or something like that, the Gaelic equivalent of Mercury. But Wotan wouldn't be an equivalent to Mercury, even though, again, he wouldn't be quite an equivalent of Jupiter or Zeus either, because then of course the Germans have Donar, who again is more popularly known as Thor in Norse mythology, who is the god of lightning. So again, you can almost say that Odin and Donar are almost combined in the form of Zeus.
I mean, the one thing I would bring up is I'm pretty sure is Mercury not in Greek tradition the god responsible for letters?
Yes, and he's also famous for having a stave or a spear. So there are parallels, certainly. But I think looking at the characteristics of Wotan, I think it's too broad a generalization.
It's also important to recognize that Tacitus, right, is writing, like 100 years later in Caesar. And, Caesar was the first Roman to cross the Rhine, so we're told. So, yeah, they really didn't know a lot about the Germans at the time. And of course, Caesar's account is... unreliable, shall we say. Yes. You know, I mean, it is a massive PR project, as we've covered. And so perhaps he's trying to portray the Germans as even more, you know, savage, yes, and feral than they, than they were, you know.
But I think it's also important to understand that because most of our understanding of the German gods does come from Roman sources, that they will in many ways, you know, try and summarize them as if they were the Roman gods in many, yeah, ways. So, for example, Fricka, who was the consort of Wotan, is very similar to Hera or Juno. We've already mentioned that Freya is similar to Aphrodite or Venus, even though there are, you know, distinctions. So, for example, Tacitus referred to a goddess known as Nerthus, who he considered to be quite similar to the Egyptian goddess Isis. And Nerthus is where we get onto the subject of the nature of human sacrifice in Germany. She's of particular interest because of her association with water, and yeah, how the sources we know attest to the Germans sacrificing humans, as well as wooden effigies in the many bogs dotted throughout Jutland or northern Germany, again, the region corresponding with the Jastav culture. Just a little plug here, but tying this into my stream with Nathan Hood on Wednesday, I do see a similarity with the bog bodies and the sacrifices made to the goddess Nerthus and the dead marshes in Lord of the Rings. There are many sources of inspiration for that, including the dead bodies of Passchendaele. But I think in terms of the specific, the preservation of the dead also in these bogs was very, very particular to this area of German mythology.
Yeah, and there's very specific. I mean, we mentioned, of course, Lindowman in our last stream, and so there was a lot.
Here we have Tolandman in this case.
Yeah. Yes. So this is a very widespread tradition, but it is fascinating how accurate Tacitus's account is, which, of course, I mean, it demonstrates just how quickly the Romans had learned. You know, in the space of a century, they had a much more advanced knowledge of the Germans, and Tacitus actually tells us that they used imagine sort of a giant wooden staple or a wedge, and they would you know, slam it over someone's hand or their chest, and they would drive them into the bog with this wedge. That's what Tacitus tells us, and we have actually found these wedges. You know, they have been preserved on many of these bodies, and so that did happen. And we also talked last time about, you know, the peculiar lack of any scarring or hard wear on a lot of the hands. And again, Tacitus tells us that the men who were plunged into the bogs in this way were men who, I mean, it's translated in a couple of ways. Some people will say unnatural lusts. Other people will say men who shamed their bodies or defiled their bodies. I think it's pretty obvious what he's getting at there. But in addition to the Germanic focus on freedom, there is also a hyper masculine culture in many ways, and weakness just seems to have been absolutely scorned, you know.
So yes, I mean, we're sort of reaching the end of the comments I have really for the mythology in terms of the perseverance of this mythology. We'll talk about the Christianization of the Germans later, but Agathias, for example, who is a 6th century Roman historian, comments that the Alemanni of the, you know, the fall of the Roman Empire, after the fall of the Western Roman Empire, were still practicing a form of essentially unbridled paganism. So I think it's important to note that this variation of paganism withstands a very long time. And here we're just talking about German paganism.
Yeah.
It's important to understand that it's variation in the North Germanic culture, the Scandinavian Germanic culture, is able, you know, to last, you know, several more centuries. Yeah. After the 7th century, yes.
I mean, far, far longer than that, I'd say, right? I mean, if we include the Vikings.
It's the majority religion, yeah. But yes, the Vikings, very much there's Christianization towards the end of the first millennium. Again, it's fascinating really how this culture endures and how it does have this and again, pertinent fascination. And as we see the recreations throughout the 19th century, when we have this renewed fascination with the German language and German paganism. Yeah.
I mean, you mentioned Velida and the sort of the importance of women and prophetesses and stuff. And if we look at Viking culture and a lot of Viking accounts, they talk about, I believe it's pronounced Saethir or Saethor, which is sort of black magic, I suppose. But it's really interesting because it seems that this sort of magic was viewed as woman's work, you know, women's magic. This was something that wise old women would do, etc. And so you link that with Tacitus's comments on the importance the Germans placed on women in rituals, and it's really interesting because there's such a span of time between these two accounts, but really interesting.
Well, an interesting thing is in respect to the women sort of question in the German sort of mythos in German society, Tacitus makes a really interesting observation at the end of the battle of Vercellae, the last battle of the Cimbri fight against Marius, or Vercellae, depending how you want to pronounce it.
Yeah.
And when the men finally yield the battlefield to the Romans, the women are more or less, cutting down their own husbands and fathers and brothers and strangling their children, so they're not basically forced into Roman captivity. Like, they're sort of the guardians of this liberty that they refuse to give to the Romans. Ghastly as that might sound to the sensibilities of modern mind, there's a degree of admirability in that.
The ancients really admired it, because I mean, it goes all the way back to, if you read Aristotle, and he talks about the natural slave. What defines a slave? It's somebody who is willing to tolerate that condition.
Yes,
which again sounds very harsh to our ears, but
which people, the Gauls and the Germans just almost refuse point blank.
And so it demonstrates that, there were peoples like this. I mean, but you see that a lot in the ancient world, at this time. People were just, in many ways, so much more extreme, But,
Yes, quite. Mm.
Yes, someone in the chat is mentioning the Sicimbrian knot. What is the sort of symbolic significance of that? Again, it's something you see typified throughout many iterations and figurines of the Germans.
Funny, it was addressed to me. I got no idea, so I want to handball this off to you, Colombo.
What did you call the Sicimbrian knot? I mean, I know the Swabian knot.
Yes, I've heard of the Swabian knot as well. I haven't heard of the Sicimbrian knot.
I know the Gordian knot, but that's about where I start and finish.
No, the Swabian knot was a sort of, you would have all your hair tied into a sort of, I guess, Princess Leia kind of ponytail on one side of your head. And that that was the marker of the Swabi, the vast sort of confederation that took up a lot of, I believe, the area around the Elbe and further east past the Rhine.
The Elbe is east of the Rhine, so it would have been the area between the Rhine and the Elbe. Just for a little geographic clarification, but I forgot what I was going to say now.
Well, yeah, no, it was just a sort of ethnic marker, an ethnic identifier of being a part of that super tribal sort of confederation.
It was kind of the antithesis, if it does have greater significance and resembles some form of free man and the essence of a free German folk. It's sort of the opposite cast of the Qing Dynasty pigtail, which of course is the illustration of the domination of the Manchus. But anyway, I think unless we have any sort of broad comments to make about the German civilization as a whole, we can dig into the chronology.
One last point I would make is the focus on horses that we see, and Tacitus tells us of a ritual that took place in one of their holy sites where they would take a chariot with sacred horses that were kept in the grove and that were never ridden by anyone, and they would hitch the horses up to the chariot, and then they would just drive it on, and they would say that the goddess was driving the chariot, or the gods were driving the chariot. And again, that's something that you see a lot, is the equestrian focus on the culture and the importance of these things, even if their equestrian nature as a people had been tamed after a thousand years of settlement. We see this continue. That's the last point I'd make.
Marcus?
I kind of have a point. Columba was talking a little bit before about Tacitus making references to the physique of the Germans. I ironically have a quote reflecting that, but it's actually from the opposite end of our timeline. It's actually an anonymous quote from the Constantinian period. So shall I read it now to respond to Columba, or shall I leave it for later?
No, you should do it now.
Okay. Sorry, let me just – I've got it in my notebook. I did write it down. And just for context sake, it was when because after Constantine became the sole emperor, he led several campaigns over the Danube to sort of pacify the Goths and the Sarmatians that were there. And he really made an effort to incorporate federati into the army to A, decrease the barbarian threat across the Danube, and B, because of the result of the civil wars between himself and Maxentius and Licinius and what have you, he did have to sort of plug the gap in the Roman manpower. So this is an anonymous quote from someone observing in Constantinople just as he had built the city. Where am I? Sorry. This front page. At the gates of the palace, you can see lines of barbarians with distinctive types of appearance, hair and beards, grim faces, terrifying glances, and unsurpassing bodily size. Some with red complexions, some pale as snow, some more black than shades of ebony. And you think that was written and observed in the 3rd century AD, or rather the 4th century AD, actually, or, you know, 300s, and the Romans' perception of the Germans and the Gauls from, you know, 500, 600, 700 years earlier was probably no different to that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you even see Arabs later on, you know, in the 12th, 13th century, referring to their massive stature. They're as tall as date palms, etc.
Very famously, Alexia Komnena in the Alexiad, you know, basically, you know, oh my God, Bowman, you're so, you know, massive, you know, you're such a huge specimen of a creature.
Absolute chads.
Yeah.
Yes, and I think that's quite a good point to sort of move on and talk about the chronology. I think, you know, one thing that we are noting consistently here is how, especially in North Germany, you know, the climate was significantly harsher than it is today. And the forests, again, Germany was significantly less deforested when compared to someone like Gaul. And the early history of the German peoples, you know, moving on, of course, we're going to be talking about the Great Migrations next week, is in many parts a history of large-scale migrations. And, you know, Tacitus mentions that this is due to the inhospitality of the climate. Again, that no one would want, preferably, to live east of the Rhine. But in terms of the context between the Germans and the classical world, and by the classical world, principally, we're talking about the Greeks and the Romans. The first sort of mention we have are through the Bastinae. And as we mentioned, that's already dubious because the Bastinae, you know, who were interacting with the Macedonians in the various conflict of the Diadochi after the death of Alexander throughout the 3rd century BC, it's dubious as to whether the Bastinae were really Germans or, again, they were mixed Celt or Scythians. The first, again, real entry of the Germans into the classical world is through the Cimbrian Wars, which, you know, start in 1103 BC and end in 101 BC. As I assume that, you know, both of you are incredibly well-versed in the chronology of the Cimbrian Wars, does anyone want to start talking about that, especially reference to, you know, why it started?
Well, I think I prattled on a lot about the culture, so I'll let Marcus take over.
I was happy to sort of play a few, but if you're going to allow me the go ahead, I shall. Well, yeah, essentially the Cimbri were a tribe that a Germanic tribe that lived around modern day Denmark, what was probably historically called Jutland, or could be referred to as Jutland, end up migrating away from modern day Denmark and that region roughly in the 120s, if I'm not mistaken. Under their king Bioryx, and soon after leaving the Jutland Peninsula, they unite with the neighbouring tribe, the Teutones, under their king Chututobald. They cross into Pannonia roughly about 113 BC, and that was actually after confrontation with the Boii, which who inhabited roughly modern-day Pannonia, which is Czechia, Czech Republic.
Yeah.
And it's from that crossing over the Danube from east to west and making their way into what the Romans would call sort of Pannonia and into Noricum, where the which tribe was it? Was it the Tauriski, I think, appealed to Rome for assistance when they were confronted with the Cimbrian migration. And the Romans actually send an army, I believe it's under Marcus Junius Silanus. And this is where the Romans get caught out with their, you might say, well, they start abandoning the Mos Maiorum and start acting dishonestly with the barbarians. And there's an agreement between Silanus and the Cimbrians and the Teutones to leave the area, and the barbarians actually agreed to this. But then Silanus attempts to lay a trap with his, I think he has an army of like roughly 30 or 40,000 legionnaires, and the Germans actually defeat them despite being ambushed. And then once the Romans are sent to flight, the Cimbri and the Teutones, and later I believe the Ambrones actually join them in this great trek across what ends up being southern Gaul into northern Spain, northern Italy, and then sort of back and forth again. And they destroy several Roman armies in this trek across southern France, northern Italy.
Sorry, Marcus. Just one point. I think it's important to note that they're not just defeated at the Battle of Noria, but they are, you know, annihilated.
Sorry, Noria. I forgot the name.
Completely.
Yes.
And what the worst thing is, you mentioned the fact that this does lead to a general, you know, pillaging of southern Gaul and of northern Hispania. But this is also, the defeat is also substantiated by the Battle of Oricio in 105 BC, which is considered to be the worst defeat since Cannae. And to make matters worse, I mean, you mentioned the fact that originally the Romans were treacherous. The Romans were, as far as I'm aware, completely divided during the Battle of Oricio. So say, for example, I think the consul...
The two consuls were at odds with each other,
Have been promoted...
Well, Capio would not be subordinate to another, you know, novo homo, another new man who was commanding the army. And basically... I think Capio attempted to attack the barbarians on his own, got completely overwhelmed. And then once the Cimbri and the Teutones worked out the deception, not that it was a deception on the part of the other consul, but just destroyed both Roman armies hand over fist. And it was an absolute slaughter. I believe, 70 or 80,000 men were killed at Arausio. It was an absolute slaughter.
I would also know, before that, in terms of the Battle of Noria, that's really important because after that first battle, I believe one of the consuls died there as well in 112.
One 109 was Noria.
No, I'm pretty sure Noria was earlier.
Okay. Oh no, sorry, you are right. No, sorry, 112, you're correct. Sorry.
Yes, yeah. Well, after that, you had a couple of Gallic tribes join the Germans, right? And the problem got even worse.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Their numbers are inflated. Yeah. Even further.
But I mean, you had like two consuls die, and then you had the massive battle at Arausio, where you had just ludicrous casualty numbers. It's like Cannae level bad.
And at that battle, a consul and a proconsul die.
And of course, the Rome itself isn't exactly stable at the time. I'm pretty sure there's all sorts of the economic problems and dissatisfactions with slaves and allies. So it's a very unstable situation. But then,
the only respite the Romans get, though, is they do intercept, I think it's the Teutones outside of Tolosa, which is modern day Toulouse, actually throw them back temporarily. But then the Romans march headlong into the barbarian trap and get more or less ambushed again at Burdigala. And Cassius Longinus, who's the ancestor of the Cassius Longinus who stabbed Caesar, is killed at the Battle of Burdigala as well. And another 25,000 legionnaires are killed.
Yeah, it was disaster after disaster. And as you substantiated, it's probably worse than the defeat of Cannae, the defeat of Oricio. So after, you know, a series of defeat after defeat after defeat, and really this could have been the end of the Roman Republic, especially the demise of the Roman provinces in the West, especially. We have the rise of Marius, you know, pictured here, the famous Marius bust. During this time, he is fighting against the Berbers in the Jugurthine Wars.
Yes.
And so how would you say, how significant is it when Marius is able to take control of the Roman forces towards the end of the war?
Well, to my understanding, I believe the limitation on land was actually revoked prior to Marius, but that was the only reform that did take place prior to him becoming consul, and the rest of the reforms occurred after he became consul. That's my understanding. But essentially, Marius returns to Rome from the Jugurthine War in Numidia, which is North Africa, modern-day Algeria, returns to Rome, realizes the absolute dire straits that Rome is in, and also recognizes, you might say this is to some degree the genesis of the Populares party, the Populares concern, insofar as identifying that Rome has a massive socio-demographic problem, as in that all of us landed citizens who would otherwise have been eligible to the Republican army, and this is another tangent, we'll bookmark it, we can go there later, perhaps the extreme, whatever. But there's a massive vacancy in landed citizens who are essentially eligible to serve in the legions as Hastati, Principes, Triarii, etc. But there's a massive what they call headcount, a jobless or landless citizens who are living in the cities and who otherwise could not serve in the Roman legions. And Marius basically reforms the army so that that headcount can sign up to the Roman army, for 20, 25 years, whatever the initial sign up length was, duration, and they could become professional soldiers. And you see that transition from that sort of semi-professional levied militia, which the old Roman army was, into a fully fledged professional force, which Marius very carefully trains retrains and restructures. They move away from maniples, they use cohorts, which is a larger unit size, they standardize equipment, they standardize everything from pila to the shields to the swords, and this army ends up being deployed into Gallia Narbonensis, I think, or at least through the Alps, they sort of intercept the Germans when they're coming back into Italy from northern Spain. Yep. And Marius is finally in a position to put Rome in a position to counter this threat, which has been hovering around its borders for the best part of, a decade or half a decade.
Yes, and you're referring to, I think, the Battle of Aquae Sextiae.
Correct.
Which is the decisive turning point. Yes. Slumber, do you have anything to contribute? Again, thank you for that summary, Marcus. That was absolutely stellar. Slumber, do you have anything to contribute?
Oh, sorry, guys. I was having a little bit of trouble there. I covered it perfectly. I cut out there for a second. Did you cover Aquae Sextiae?
Yes, we just covered Aquae Sextiae. We haven't, Marcus has already mentioned the final defeat of the Teutones at Vercellae, which is, again, the second battle to complement Aquae Sextiae. Do you have anything to complement to this discussion on the Cimbrian Wars?
I would say this is the start of the populist cause. I mean, of course, that goes back to the Gracchi, etc. But this is the first time they really achieve power. And in Rome, what we see is that the most important legitimizing factor is victory in war, right? But not only, of course, they're not Gauls, right? These are German tribes, but they do have Gauls with them. And they are considered, cousins. They're considered northern barbarians, and so this has a great PR and aesthetic appeal, because the sack of Rome by the Gauls, by Brennus, which we've talked about, left a deep impression on the Roman mindset. And so it's a very important development to see the populists becoming the sort of scions of military glory in a way that they hadn't been able to before. We do know that Tiberius Gracchus, who of course, he was from Scipio Africanus's family, so military prestige, but he was only, I'm pretty sure he was given a command and he requited himself very well, but it was a minor command, but the people did love him for it. And so we do see
this in the third Punic War.
I believe so. Around the time of Scipio Aemilianus, I think he might have been serving under when it was just a fiasco, and he did very well, which shows you how clued up the people in the city of Rome were about military operations abroad. The very important moment for the populares, and of course Marius was the uncle of Julius Caesar, who I assume we'll get to next, actually.
Yes, absolutely. We move on. Again, that's the first major iteration. And again, I would say it's fair to say that this establishes a firm hatred of the Germans in the minds of the Roman populace, which will again help and aid in Caesar's conquest, which we'll get to. So when we have the beginning of the Gallic Wars, in terms of understanding the Helvetii, as far as I'm concerned, again, correct me if I'm wrong, but the Helvetii weren't Germanic peoples. They came from Raetia, which is, the modern-day region of Switzerland. But the first sort of major encounter between Caesar in the Gallic Wars and the Germans is with the Suebi under Ariovistus, when he defeats them at the Battle of Vosges in Vosges in 58. Am I correct?
Yes, and Ariovistus was in fact, he had been named a friend of the Roman people, I believe, which demonstrates that there was some interchange and interaction, because by Caesar's time, a lot of Germany was still mysterious, but this is what, about 50, 60 years since Marius?
The Battle of Vercellae was either in 102 or 101,
yeah.
And the invasion of by Caesar was 58, so we're talking, you know, 43 years.
Yeah, and of course, right, and in this whole period, Roman economic political control is expanding northward, expanding into Gaul, and so they do have some relations with the Germans. But yeah, the situation is mysterious from what we can tell. Again, we come back to the debate about how much Caesar is romanticizing things for his political career, but I think there's a good argument there. I mean, he was decreed something, you know, all the days of Thanksgiving after crossing the Rhine. So I do think there was a genuine fascination with what Caesar was doing.
Yes, in terms of, again, the wider significance in terms of, you know, the defeat of Ariovistus, this again represented yet another migration from the inhospitable territories of Germany into richer Gallic lands, potentially, as we saw with the Cimbrians, potentially Roman lands as well. One of the effects, again, the course of Caesar's campaign takes him through Alsace and through Belgica. The effect of this is the dispersal of what he refers to as the Germani Cicerahani, or the left bank Germans. And from, you know, essentially after the Battle of Vosges, we arrive at Tacitus' definition, whereby the definitive border of Germania, so such as it exists at all, is now set at the Rhine. Would you say that's fair?
Yeah,
even totally, though, again, 100%. we have the definitions of Germania inferior and Germania superior. Germania superior, including, of course, the Agri Decumatis. But these regions very much were considered part of the Roman world, and Germania was almost a epithet to refer to everything beyond the Roman world, so to speak. In the north, especially.
Not talking about
east when it comes to Scythia, later Sarmatia, but definitely the regions beyond the Danube and the Rhine.
What's interesting too is and not to obviously send this down a tangent, but just as a comment about this particular subject, is that funny how the Romans sort of see Germania as being beyond the Rhine and the Gaul is everything west of the Rhine, and how that would have implications many centuries later for the foreign policies of France and Germany.
Yes,
but I'll leave that there.
That's interesting. Just to elaborate on that, and we'll get to this eventually, many months down the line.
I promise I won't nudge it in that direction.
Yeah. Yes, when we arrive at the, again, but this is interesting because it's the inspiration of neoclassicism in the French Revolutionary era. And they, of course, that define the natural borders. Oh, sorry, my computer's going on. You have to speak.
Yeah, the natural borders of France, which I believe were the Pyrenees, the Alps, and the Rhine River, according to the Bonapartists and to the Bourbons, the royal family of France.
I suppose you've got to use what you have.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just an interesting thought that geographical limitation is kind of like unwittingly established by the Romans many, many centuries earlier, sort of unwittingly.
Yeah, I think the Romans were unwittingly establishing a lot of things.
So
we have Ariovistus, and that was in 58, right? And then you come to, I believe, you have like Caesar he intervenes in a sort of tribal dispute a couple of years after this. And of course, he's not spending all of his time in Germany and in Gaul. He's, you know, back to Rome, back up, wheeling and dealing.
I believe after he builds the bridge, crosses the Rhine, he's only on the far side of the Rhine for like maybe 18, 20 days. Yeah. And then he crosses the river and then burns the bridge. It's like, oh, well, I can come back at will whenever. So don't forget it, Germans, you know, Caesar.
It's a show of force, isn't it? But I'm pretty sure he claims something ludicrous, like he massacred like 100,000 people, women and children.
It's Caesar. He's just boasting, you know.
I love that. I love that he's just allowed to boast about that. But we do see, don't we? We see the Senate trying to come after him for war crimes, which I think is rich. But,
Well, not that I love it, but just for the sake of the discussion, as a reflection, you know, the Romans can literally, you know, destroy Carthage and completely ransack Corinth in the previous century, and you know, suddenly Caesar's being trolled for war crimes. It's like, well, nice consistent application of policies here, Senate. Well done.
Sounds familiar, to be honest.
Sorry, just go in the chat saying Chad Caesar.
Chad Caesar, yes.
It reminds me. Someone's been watching too much Dover Hattie. If we're going to
Dover Hattie, I'm familiar.
You must know him. The unbiased History of Rome series.
It's the best. It's so good.
It's wonderful satire. I'll check it out, Columba. Not necessarily as an accurate historical portrayal.
I'll take a look at that after this.
To have an animated scene about the Nika rites with Johann Strauss's Frühlingsstummen in the background is quite the amazing thing. So thank you, Dover Hattie. That's quite wonderful.
Okay, enough free plugs, okay?
Okay, back to task, boys.
So then we're in 54 with Caesar's expedition across the Rhine, and then he goes to Britain. But then we have there's uprising, and one of the legions gets wiped out by Germans, right? In 54, I believe one of Caesar's legions gets destroyed or gets ambushed. I can't remember exactly. And so then Caesar crosses the Rhine again the next year. I think so, right?
Yes, you'll have to elaborate on the very specific terminology of the Gallic Wars, because I do not know that in that much detail. I don't really think, again, it's that really significant to talk about Caesar's interaction, because of course then he gets embroiled in the Roman Civil War after this. Nevertheless, it's important to understand that this is where the Romans establish the border at the Rhine. When we get to the period after Caesar, so after the Civil War also concluded, the Romans begin to make inroads again under the Emperor Augustus. And they don't just do this in Germania, they do this everywhere. You could say the period of Augustus is the greatest period of sort of Roman consolidation. You know, the Romans expand
into
the East, they expand into North Africa, they again annexing Egypt, which is, you know, the largest conquest of Augustus's reign, and of course they consolidate their control over Hispania, but they also expand into Germania as well. And I guess the common assumption is that had the Romans been successful, they would have pushed their border, at least temporarily, up to the Elbe River, as opposed to the Rhine River. And this is where we have one of the most interesting sort of Germanic protagonists of the period, which is the arrival of Arminius. So in terms of sort of setting up Arminius, would you like to sort of describe German tribal interaction with the Romans up to this point, and, you know, why Arminius was sent to Rome essentially to become trained and educated as a Roman, having previously been a member of the Cherusci tribe, or again, continue to be a member of the Cherusci tribe?
He was a noble of the Cherusci, and I believe he was sent to Rome like many young nobles as a sort of I suppose a sort of diplomatic hostage, but he wasn't just a noble. He was the son of the chief, wasn't he?
He was one of the sons of the chief. I think both the sons of the chief went.
Segamir, was it?
Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Him and his brother Flavus were sent to Rome.
And then he was in the army.
Also than the army, he rose. Very successfully during the army. I think he was given Roman citizenship. Beyond that, he was actually given the status of equites, which, you know, obviously in Rome is the rank of knight, which is below that of patrician. And he served with distinction on the Roman side, commanding the Cherusci auxiliaries during the Illyrian revolts at the beginning of the period AD. So not only, you know, was he sent to Rome as part of this again extension of the Pax Romana into Germany, the forming of tribal alliances, but he not only, you know, became well versed in Roman tactics, you know, was able to speak Latin,
and he also served under Varus himself, did he not?
Yeah.
Towards the end, yes. I mean, he was, you know, the head of the Cherusci auxiliaries, and he had, as I've stated, you know, performed with, you know, total distinction in Israel and putting down the Illyrian revolt. So I think
if there's a slight irony here as well, if you look at where Arminius was during the Illyrian revolt, he actually was almost in the same part of the fighting as later Germanicus, who they would after the you know, the slaughter at Teutoburg Forest, Germanicus and Arminius would become quite bitter enemies. But during the events of 6 to 9 AD, they were more or less fighting in the same part of Illyria for the Roman cause against the Illyrians.
Yeah, and so now I suppose we come to the Varian disaster, right? Which 9 AD.
Yes, 9 AD is the Varian disaster. So, you know, we've established
the fateful year.
The Augustus had expanded into Germany. And again, there wasn't really anything impeding German expansion. As we mentioned, you know, as with the Gallic elites, many of the German elites were being co-opted into the Roman elite. So very much we could have seen a similar process of assimilation and conquest. But of course, that goes terribly wrong in 9 AD. So does anyone want to go into the details regarding that?
Just before we sort of head there, another thing to sort of consider too is, given the German interaction with, not to say back to Caesar, but the interaction with Gaul during Caesar's Gallic War, there's almost this sort of bleed into, well, the Romans have incorporated Gaul into Rome, and therefore, by extension, the Roman influence kind of spills into Germany by happenstance, because yes, you have these German incursions, you have the hiring of German mercenaries by Caesar, and you have these sort of German tribes, like the Cherusci, for instance, who actually are Roman allies. I think the Chatii are Roman allies as well. And yeah, so there's this sort of incremental, almost sort of incidental creep of Roman influence beyond the Rhine. And so as Augustus is sort of naturalizing the Roman borders to sort of defensible frontiers, be it the Syrian desert, at Africa, the Danube, etc., the Elbe seems the next logical step. And so it's almost this process that kind of just rolls on with this natural inertia.
And we can also note that I believe it's in the 20s BC, you know, before this, in the period of consolidation, you couldn't have the kind of fortifications that were set up along the Rhine and in Germany without, you know, constant supplies and a lot of infrastructure. And so in the decades coming up to this, we in addition to the consolidation, we see, you know, the first Roman road networks, which are established and built by Agrippa in Gaul. And all of these things serve to support the frontier. But yeah, we see just this gradual push up from the south heading north of infrastructure.
But even Roman settlements, as far as I'm aware, there was also at the beginning of a Roman city in Lanao, which was again evacuated as a result of the defeat of Teutoburg. But I think, you know, very much we're getting to the point. So does anyone want to sort of go over the story of Teutoburg Forest?
So we had rebellions in the Balkans in the east, and Varus was delegated to, I believe, bring some of the legions from Germany east to help. Arminius, who was, as we've said, serving in the army, leading the auxiliaries, he brought Varus a report of a rebellion of two German tribes in the north. And diverted the army.
Sorry, Columba. One point to note. We mentioned the Illyrian revolt. I think it's also important to note that the number of legions in Germania itself was reduced as a result of the Illyrian revolts. I think usually it would be 6, and it was reduced to 3. And of course, Arminius, who was involved in the Illyrian revolts, would have had full knowledge of that the German forces were temporarily weakened.
Yeah,
exactly. Which is why when Germanicus goes there afterwards, basically the Rhine frontier is defenseless because of the massacre. Sorry, go on, Columba.
I was just, yeah, and so they're marching on the way to this place. They're marching through a location which I assume had been known to Arminius or pointed out to him or had been discovered. It was very good because the Romans could only march, I believe, you know, 3 men abreast, and it was very heavily wooded and uneven path, and so you know, I mean, Roman military success relies on organization, machinery, entrenchment, and none of these things were possible. And so you had 3 legions coming through this very long, very narrow path in the middle of the forest heading north, and they were ambushed, a classic ambush by Arminius, the Cherusci, and their allies, who just absolutely swarmed the Romans before they had the time to make any formations and wiped out pretty much 3 legions, which amounts to you know, at least 15,000 men. And it was just, it was an absolute disaster. Varys himself committed suicide. We're told that when Augustus heard word of the disaster in Rome, he went to the nearest pillar and started banging his head off of the pillar, saying, "Varys, give me back my legion." which is pretty. It's a wonderful story.
The interesting thing with that as well is that the as much as it's a sort of wonderful example of a set piece ambush, which arguably has few comparisons in all history, never mind antiquity, probably sort of Trasimene is the only one that's up there, but. The Trasimene doesn't have the deception that Arminius has. Like, Arminius has the most godly patience and
yeah, he must have been so cool,
daring, you know? and the stones to be standing in that Roman tent with Varys for that long and pretending to be an ally. Meanwhile, you know, this sort of this crescendo event is sort of coming up. But what's actually quite interesting is that the battle nearly didn't happen, because once Varys got into Cherusci territory, he was quite happy to sit in his tent and take petitions from the locals and basically arbitrate justice. And Arminius has to sort of conspire to have his allies, in inverted commas, attack Cherusci territory and say, and then sort of go to Varys and say, "Oh, we need to like attack these people who are attacking us because we're your allies. So you need to, you know, deploy the legions out of this fortress and attack these people attacking Cherusci territory." And then that's what draws Varys out of the Roman fortress in the allied Cherusci territory. And then they go through the fateful pass in the Citta di Burgovald, and that ambush, that perfectly executed ambush, takes place, and those three legions are annihilated to a man.
Yeah, and so the armies pull back to the Rhine, pretty much, and that's where they'll be for the considerable future until you get to an expansion under Domitian. But in terms of the fate of Arminius and the immediate response to this,
I think it's important to mention. Sorry, my thing's gone again.
Oh, that computer's a demon.
We'll persevere despite technical issues.
We'll persevere.
Unlike Varys, we'll persevere.
Yes.
I'm off again.
So it was about 5 years after this disaster. Germanicus, I believe it's Germanicus, and he's around at this point.
15-16 AD, to my understanding.
Yeah,
Germanicus crosses the Rhine,
and this is the son of the previous Germanicus.
Well, his father Nero Claudius Drusus is the one who falls off his horse and dies in 9 AD, just as him and Tiberius are on the verge of pacifying Germania. Then, as we know, there's the great revolt in Illyria. They have the setback in Germania. Varys loses his legion, and it's the son of Drusus that dies from the horse accident, is the Germanicus we're talking about.
And he, of course, very important figure. There's a mutiny amongst the legions in Germany, because at the same time, around 13 AD, this is when Augustus dies and Tiberius becomes emperor, right? 14,
correct,
I believe.
14.
Yeah, and so when this happens, many of the men in the legions, the legionary camps in Pannonia and Germany, demand, they don't like Tiberius for whatever reason. They believe that they can get better terms, of, you know, a higher donative, higher wages under Germanicus, who they have a lot of affection for, the German legions, because of his father. But Germanicus stays loyal, and he manages to bring the men under control. Hang the ringleaders. Apparently Tiberius's son Drusus came along, and they got lucky because the moon was covered up by clouds, and the Roman soldiers, being superstitious, thought that the goddess was displeased with them, and so they must stop their treason, or at least that's what that Tacitus says that in the annals.
I believe Germanicus also threatened to commit suicide if they tried to don purple on him.
Yes.
The legion is tried. So it's like, you can acclaim the emperor, but I'll kill myself. And they're like, no, don't do that. No. You're our favorite.
and so it's after this in 15. This is when we see the punitive raids against the Cherusci and the other tribes that were responsible for the Varian disaster by Germanicus and the legions. He has something like 8 legions at his command, and they go in and just start burning swathes of land for miles.
And never mind, he builds fleets specifically to venture down the Weser and the Elbe rivers to like launch sort of seaborne campaigns and attack them from multiple directions at once. Like Germanicus spares nothing in his retaliatory campaigns. He uses every means at his disposal to.
And they have some successes, but they have some failures. I mean, you mentioned the navy. I'm pretty sure there was a massive disaster, and a lot of the navy was lost.
But
two of the eagles are recovered. Two of the legionary eagles, which of course were like the pride of each legion, and they were recovered by Germanicus.
Yeah, because Varus lost the 17th, 18th, and 19th to recollection.
Yes, and so in terms of the Germans, we have because this doesn't go very far because Germanicus has these expeditions, but then he's coming back to Rome. And then under somewhat mysterious circumstances, he's removed to Asia. Germanicus is removed to Asia to become the governor there and dies under very suspicious circumstances. And so he's sort of out of the picture. And I would say that the situation on the Rhine sort of stabilizes from that point on for some time. I mean, there's minor raids and you know.
I think Tiberius sort of accepts it as a sort of a strategic fait accompli as well, you know.
Well, Tiberius was meant to have been quite reserved, wasn't he?
I'm back just before my computer will play up again. I really need to buy a new one if this stream has told me anything. Yes, I think Tiberius also has no real intention of fulfilling Augustus's plan to expand to the Elbe. So I think, again, there's a strategic decision within Rome not to expand and to basically abandon the series of conquests. There is, a strong tactical reasoning for that. I think it's important to understand that the region of Germania is very hard to resupply. You know, Gaul, say, for example, is very easy to resupply. From the sea, you know, both from the Mediterranean and, you know, from the Atlantic. But, you know, deeper into Germania, especially with the very primitive infrastructure that was there, very hard to, again, establish a vast military presence, especially considering, as we mentioned, the climate in Germany was much poorer than it is today. It still wasn't a very deforested region. So the actual worth of the conquest was, you know, negligible. So it would have essentially put a massive strain on Roman resources when the empire in many areas was already overstretched.
Yeah, and logistics, because you end up with a sort of massive salient, right, which is much harder to defend.
Although there's one thing to consider, and I'm sort of might be strategically nitpicking here, but the only thing that works for the Roman advantage is if they push the frontier to the Elbe, they do shorten the Danubian length of the Danubian frontier by at least a couple hundred kilometers as well, and that's to be considered. But that's neither here nor there, and we're getting into old history at that point. But just a food for thought.
We should also mention that a couple years soon after Germanicus's mysterious death in the East, Arminius, like you mentioned, is assassinated by his own people who had cut a deal with the Romans or were allied with the Romans.
And also there was that dispute too with because the fact that he took off with whose daughter, the princess, what's her name? I've just gone blank.
Thusnelda?
Thusnelda, yeah. And her father is essentially, you know, pissed at Arminius for doing it. And in fact, it's her father who goes to Varus just before the disaster and actually finger points Arminius out in front of all the Romans in the camp, but Varus doesn't believe him.
Which demonstrates, I suppose, just how cool Arminius could be. Dastardly figure, he was still very young as well. He was only his 20s, early 20s. Very capable. In terms of major events after this, I don't think we really have anything until Nero and the Batavian Revolt, right? So I think it might be a good idea to sort of to discuss the importance of the Batavians. So there was a one thing which comes to mind, and the Batavians, this is modern day the Netherlands, where the Rhine meets the sea. And this area was very important. There was the tribe that lived there, the Batawi. They were some of the most trusted auxiliary forces in the Roman army. They actually made up, you had the Germani Corpore Custodes, who were the, so you had the Praetorian Guard in Rome, who fulfilled a lot of state functions, but you also had the emperor's personal bodyguard, and it was made up of Germans. Some people think because of the German idea of loyalty, you know, and of course this is in Germania Inferior. These are trusted men. We're told that when one of the emperors was assassinated, they just went wild in rage. You know, they were less easily bought than the Praetorians, I suppose. But during the reign of Nero, there's a lot of dissatisfaction amongst the battalions. Their leader, Iulius Civilis, who had served the Romans faithfully, he was arrested because he was accused of part in a conspiracy against Nero, falsely, we believe. And it's after this, the chaos of Vindex's revolt and Nero's suicide, I believe this is when Civilis takes his opportunity, and you have a massive revolt around late 60s, 70. There are multiple reasons for this. We have high taxes, opportunism. Tacitus tells us that the centurions, the recruiting centurions, had actually committed outrages on the boys of the battalions, which God only knows what that means, right? But there's all sorts of insults done to the people, and then there's a real explosion of not only rebellious but Germanic, pan-Germanic sentiment. Civilis manages to get a lot of the other Germanic tribes on side, right? Could you maybe expand on the military side of that, Marcus?
Actually, the Batavian Revolt is something I actually don't know a whole lot about, to be perfectly honest with you. Needless to say, I was aware of their role and essentially their position as being very esteemed auxiliaries and almost or essentially a sort of not a rival, but a sort of co-unit alongside the Praetorian Guard as being considered a bodyguard of the emperor. And the fact that the Batavians did time and again actually prove themselves very effective on the battlefield as an auxiliary unit, arguably one of the best in the Roman army. But as for the revolt per se, I really can't add to what you said.
I mean, I think it was Cerealis. He was one of the generals at the time who dealt with the revolt. But I think that's actually another reason for the revolt happening in the first place is that after Nero's death, Galba, the new emperor, didn't want to have the Germanic bodyguard because there was a lot of distrust of the Germans at the time, and the Batavians were insulted by this. Oh, we've lost AM.
Oh, no, he said he was going to restart because of his little issue.
I see. Okay.
And what I was going to say is that just for bearing for the audience, for those who don't know, with the death of Nero, we're entering the year of the four emperors. So Galba is – now, was Galba the general of the Rhine legions?
I think so. I think he had a position there, yeah.
Yeah, because we have – because in the year of the four emperors, Galba, Vitius, Otho, and then eventually the last one is deposed by Vespasian, who marches back from the east just as his son Tiberius is mopping up the great Jewish revolt. But Vespasian heads to Italy at the end of that year and becomes emperor.
Yeah. And after this, I can't think. What do we have? I mean, we have settlement in the Agri Decumates, which is a
the man with the chronology has just left us briefly, so we're going to have to just improvise.
I mean, the part that I can remember next in terms of the Germans would probably be the Marcomannic Wars with Marcus Aurelius.
Yeah, because we're venturing to Marcus Aurelius. But what you said about the Agri Decumates, we sort of see the establishment of the firming up to the frontier. They're sort of consolidating because that sort of, for those who don't know, the Agri Decumates is what links the Rhine and the Danube rivers. And it's this series of fortifications and what the Romans call defensive earthworks and fortifications that sort of solidify and fortify that border. And the Romans realized that between those two rivers they're most vulnerable, so they actually put a lot of emphasis in making that a real defensive sort of hub of their Rhine Danube frontier.
Yeah, definitely. So the Marcomannic Wars more your forte. What do you think of our friend Marcus Aurelius?
I'm back. Can I mention one point? I know we've sort of jumped ahead in the chronology to the Macromanic Wars. Can I go back slightly to Arminius? I mean, we already mentioned that he was assassinated. We've surmised, you know, various reasons as to why he was assassinated, basically betraying this idea of kingship. But also, I think it's important to note that in addition to the war with Germanicus, there was also the internal war among the German tribes with the, again, bringing the Macromanni back into this, with the Macromanni themselves, who would then relocate to Bohemia, and Arminius's war with the King Marbod. But in terms of the significance of Arminius, I want to bring this back because this is, of course, an overarching series of streams, which talks about German history as a whole. And I really want to discuss the historical significance of Arminius. So in terms of like mythos, again, the we have, of course, the allusion to him essentially being an inspiration for Siegfried in The Ring of the Nibelungen, and Fafner being some sort of allegory for the Romans. In terms of, you know, the first sort of person to see him as an allegory for sort of German nationalism, I think was Martin Luther. Martin Luther, who very much saw him and his conflict with the papacy as, again, somewhat synonymous with the attack again of the defeat of Varus by Arminius. Going further into this, I think it's important to note that German historiography, of course, has been quite warped since the denazification process and the, or you can almost say, the curtailing of any sort of semblance of German nationalism piece by piece. So in West German historiography after the war, we have what you can say almost like a process of forgetting, or almost feeling humiliated by Arminius, almost as if it would have been better had the Romans been a civilizing process against this, you know, unholy German
this authoritarian personality.
Actually, someone quite insightfully, I think at the beginning of the chat, mentioned that about how like the modern Germans kind of almost have disdain for Arminius. It was an interesting comment because we've just actually brushed into that now. It's whoever said that, good on you. You predicted it before.
I did have a picture of the Hermanns Denkmal, the Hermann monument, which I've lost because I've just had to restart my computer.
It's an impressive thing.
But it's funny you mentioned that, AM, because what I was actually going to say is, because in the previous chat we were obviously talking about Gaul and how sort of Vercingetorix sort of is sprouted up in this sort of the post-Enlightenment era as this sort of nationalistic figure for France, even though he's a Gaul and he's not actually French per se. There's like a resurrection of his image in that sort of post-Enlightenment period is sort of like a symbol of French defiance and nationalism. There's that massive bronze statue of Vercingetorix, I think, near the site of Alesia. And statues of Arminius begin to be erected around the time of German unification.
Yes, absolutely.
And Arminius is seen as something of a historical figure that's sort of comparable to Vercingetorix.
It's interesting because there's almost two Arminiuses. I mean, the German nationalist figure is, of course, Hermann, who you could almost say is like a modern-day sort of romantic retelling of Arminius, hence we have the Hermanns Denkmal, which is this absolutely massive statue erected to him even before the process of German unification, very much after the emergence of German nationalism in the wake of the French Revolution. And this is a massive monument that is constructed between 1838 and 1870 on the site apparently of the original Teutoburger Forest. And of course, as you mentioned, the symbol of Germania itself is very much, you can say, a 19th century romanticism of, you know, the ideal of a unified German people as typified by Hermann. But going back to the Western German historiography, we mentioned, you know, this curtailing of German nationalism in the wake of World War II. East Germany, interestingly enough, had their own revision of Hermann, so to speak. And they were able to recharacterize him as some sort of proto-socialist hero.
The collectivist German hero.
Yes, I've not read about this.
Yes, in contrast to, East German historiography referred to Rome as the Sklavenhaltgesellschaft, which means basically the Roman slaveholder society. And so
bourgeoisie empire kind of thing.
Yes, the ultimate bourgeoisie empire. So very much the East German historiography was based on trying to find in German society some form of proto-socialism, and this to some extent is actually substantiated by Caesar himself. I have this little extract from Caesar, which according to him, Germanic peoples did not own private property, but that the land, the property of the entire tribe, was distributed by tribal leaders and occupied for a specific amount of time. Such measures were intended to prevent members of the tribe from becoming settled agriculturalists and to prevent wealth concentration, which would become a source of instability, but also so the tribe, I think, could quickly migrate in the case of the very temperamental weather patterns. And again, when we look at the German legal records, because of course I think it's important to note that the Germans did have a legal system in, you know, the pre-Christian Germanic society, and it tended to revolve around property and, among other things, the Wehrguild, which was a form of basically price. resolving tribal feuds of a feud through blood money. So again, obviously this is a post-World War II recharacterization to try and there's some form of historical link between East Germany and Hermann. And of course they would do this with Wagner in the same way that a lot of German nationalism would be I would say revised and again updated for this new communist regime.
Just rewinding, just prior to the, let's just say, the as our friend academic agent calls it, the mid-century Germans, if we can just wind back prior to before that period, and you mentioned, what was that, what the monument called, the Hermanns Denkmal. Yeah, the Hermanns Denkmal. I actually stumbled across something which I think everyone finds, but particularly you, is there's a German what you might call Volkslieder, like a patriotic song, and it has the title Ich hab mich ergeben, and it was composed around the time, I believe, of I think post-just unification, and in the lyrics actually is a reference to Hermannsland. Now I can't think of another German hero who they would be referencing in the song. And if you actually look at the lyrics of it, may I just read the sentence?
Yeah, sure.
It goes, du Lande frei und frommen, du herrlich Hermannsland. So there's a dedication there to Hermannsland. And if they're not talking about Arminius, I have no idea who they're talking about. And that's a very interesting little thing I just I stumbled across by happenstance, but I absolutely had to tell you because I thought you'd love it.
No, absolutely. And I do think very much we have this, as with France and the revision to the natural borders, as in Germany, corresponding with this nationalism, we have this, again, reversion, this recall of the Roman classics, and that this is, you know, proliferated again through the culture by Wagner. So I think that was quite a little point I wanted to put across before we move on to the macro. So yes, please do go ahead with Marcus Aurelius.
Marcus, would you like to talk about Marcus Aurelius?
All I'll say in regards to Marcus Aurelius is I'm astonished that given he was prosecuting the Marcomannic War, that he actually still had the time and the energy to write his Meditations. I sadly haven't actually completed reading Meditations. I've only read excerpts of it, bits and pieces. But it's funny that how an emperor who was so governed by personal moderation and self-discipline was sort of lumped into the circumstance where he was fighting these sort of almost perpetual wars, or at least skirmishes and sort of conflicts on that the Danube frontier. And really it was in that golden period of Rome where Rome would, for the last time in its history, really assert itself in this position of indisputable dominance. And it's following the good emperors, and then subsequently following the collapse of the Severan dynasty, which as we've since worked out was the death of Severus Alexander, Rome just never has that period of undisputed sort of ascendancy amongst its neighbors, and this decline sort of occurs from Marcus Aurelius afterwards. But did you want to talk more about the Marcomannic War specifically?
I mean, we could just mention the date. This is 160s to 180s.
Sorry, yes.
And this pretty much persisted for almost all of poor Marcus's reign.
Yeah, he's very preoccupied with it.
Well, yeah, not only is he preoccupied with this, I mean, one of the reasons why these wars were so devastating and why Rome was vulnerable, because there was no civil war. It was quite a stable period. You had a plague had swept through in the reign of the previous emperor, Antoninus. It gets called the Antonine Plague. And it's said to have killed an estimated 6 million people, perhaps up to 8 million people.
And it also killed Marcus Aurelius's would-be co-emperor too, Lucius Verus,
yes, who seems to have been quite a Chad, but
quite sadly for history, he didn't make it.
Damn shame. He had great hair, if the busts are to be believed.
Yes.
It's a time of increasing instability, and like you say, Roman authority begins to fall apart. Although the wars are handled very well, and it takes a massive marshalling of resources on behalf of Rome. I believe at one point we have something like 13 legions fighting the Marcomannic Wars.
Which is approximately, I think, 35 or 40% of all Roman fighting strength concentrated just in that one area.
I'm not even sure that's including auxiliaries. So so it's a vast number of men and it goes on for decades.
Because I know for certain at the death of Hadrian, I think Rome had other 30 or 31 legions.
Something like that,
across the empire, because I just want to make a quick reflection, just briefly. But Hadrian makes a boast to one of his counselors about, you know, who are you to question me? I'm the emperor of Rome who commands 30 legions. Because like someone picked him up on his grammar because he was born in Spain, and that was his famous retort to a rhetorician that was lecturing him in the Senate. But there's quite an interesting sort of comparison here, is that you have Augustus consolidating, pushing out the empire, sort of rationalizing its boundaries, and then sort of Tiberius sort of consolidating those boundaries. And you kind of have a similar thing when you fast forward to the period of the good emperors, where Trajan undertakes this expansion into Dacia, into the Middle East, he attacks Parthia, extends the Roman Empire to its greatest geographical extent. You know, the Romans make it to the Red Sea for the first time. They've established the province of Dacia. And then under Hadrian, he actually pulls back, not from Dacia, but from Mesopotamia and Assyria and the Near East, and sort of reconsolidates these borders, famously builds Hadrian's Wall in Britannia. And Marcus Aurelius, kind of like Tiberius's successors, fortunately inherits an empire that is has reinforced itself in a defensive posture. And you might say, if anyone was fortunate enough to have to fight the Marcomanni Wars, it is Marcus Aurelius, because there's Antoninus Pius in between there as well, but he's the inheritor of this empire that has solidified itself defensively.
In many ways, I would view the Marcomannic Wars as a sort of presaging, or a foreboding of what was to come later with the invasions and the migrations proper after the crisis of the third century.
The difference though, you could almost say that Marcus Aurelius, had he lived longer, would have had a more proactive response to deal with the German situation forever. I mean, of course, this isn't attacking the main frontier of the Germans, which is on the Rhine. This is attacking via the Danube. Pannonia and even Aquileia in northern Italy are, raided by the Macromannis in addition to the Quadi. So really, we almost have the evaporation of the province of Roman Pannonia and the reconsolidation and reconquest of this territory. But you could say that again, indulging in counterfactual history, had Marcus Aurelius lived and not been succeeded by the peace-lover Commodus, had he consolidated his position from Vindobona and, moved north, he could have expanded into what is now Bohemia, which was the main territory of the Macromanni, and continued to launch punitive campaigns, almost as a position of course for the later Roman Empire to preemptively destroy a German confederation ever sort of forming to threaten Rome, like the Macromanni had. I think it's also important to note, as you mentioned, with the Antonine Plague, I mean, on the one hand, yes, Marcus Aurelius was fortunate to have been preceded by the good emperors, but on the other hand, he did have to deal with one of the greatest demographic shocks to the empire until really the plague of Justinian in the sixth century.
I'm pretty sure in terms of this idea of seeing stuff that we see later, at the end of this war, you mentioned the peace loving or the party loving Commodus, Marcus Aurelius's son, who pretty much ended the wars somewhat abruptly, I suppose. I believe as part of the settlement that was come to, many German settlers were moved south, were moved into Italy and across the Danube, and a couple of provinces were created. There was a province called Marcomania which was created, and I suppose this is certainly a presaging of the kind of wholesale appropriation and the situation that we see later with the vast numbers of aliens that are in the Roman administration and making use of the Roman administration, which we discussed in the first episode of our Politeia podcast, the allies and the barbarian they become ever more able to move within the administration until things become very unstable. And of course, Rome just it gets to the point where they're just handing out increasingly huge sums of gold just to keep the barbarians off of their back, and it becomes quite the shoe is definitely on the other foot.
It's funny how AM actually touched on sort of counterfactuals and the fact that Marcus Aurelius didn't live long enough. It's funny how it occurred to Marcus Aurelius himself and the Marcus Aurelius of the Middle Ages. And for those of you who are Byzantists in the chat, they call John II Comnenus the Marcus Aurelius of the Middle Ages. And both him and Marcus Aurelius died prematurely, just as their empires are on the cusp of some degree of stability. That's just an interesting, history doesn't repeat itself, but it very often rhymes.
Fate dealeth ever as she must.
Exactly.
Yes, and I think before my computer explodes, we should arrive at the third century, and the I would guess the composition of the new German tribes. So in the 200s, I'd say we have the Suevians again, who comprise the broad coalition of Germans between the Elbe and the Rhine in Swabia, and what would later become the Agrodecumates. They are replaced by the Alemanni. And in the east, we also have the arrival of the Gothic peoples, and they would again become a serious perennial problem for the Germans, so much so that in 250, the Gothic king Cniva would kill the Emperor Decius at the Battle of Abritus. And, you know, the Goths would go throughout and, you know, raid the provinces of Mysia and Thrace, and even, you know, threaten cities like Thessalonica. And again, we also have Germans breaching the Rhine, I think, during the reign of the Emperor Probus. You know, during that time also, this is the time of Aurelian. We have the temporary division of the empire, and the Gallic and the Batavian German general becoming the emperor of the. Sorry, my computer's playing up again.
Oh yeah, no, but he's talking about Postumus, who, yeah, it's thought by some that he was actually of Batavian ancestry, and he was the we talked about the Gallic Empire, which was set up in the northwest, and then you had the Palmarine Empire in the east, and it was reunited by Aurelian.
Posthumus is almost like a proto Stilicho, you know, like a sort of a barbarian descended sort of Roman who, you know, fights the Roman cause in a sense.
Yeah, definitely. I wonder though, in terms of the movements of the Alemanni, like what was the motivation there? Was it the Goths coming in and then pushing them? Because I thought the Goths came a bit later.
Well, I have a feeling that much can be said. I think there's a lot of logic to the theory that with the Romans having bordered these German peoples, you know, by the time we get to the Christ of the third century, they have been in contact for, you know, a good couple of centuries, and they've been trading with each other. They've been skirmishes. Obviously, the Romans had famously attempted to annex Germania, and then you have the Marcomanni Wars. There's this increasing familiarity between the two cultures and the two peoples. And I think to some degree, the Germans or the German peoples and the respective sort of subdivisions of those tribes observe casually that Roman strength is waning, that as they sort of probe the German, as the Germans probe the Roman frontiers, the resistance is not as strong as it once was. Perhaps the legions aren't as well led as they once were. Perhaps they're not as disciplined as they once were, or as well equipped as they once were. And to take on this empire that has, 30 legions deployed. And one thing that a lot of people don't actually realize too is that it's not like the Roman army just declines. There's a strange sort of a dynamic that occurs through the Christ of the third century, through the Constantinian age, up until sort of, you know, you could say probably Majorian, where the empire's the size of the standing army, the legions, actually increases from approximately 320,000 up to 600,000 men. And to consider that for an empire in antiquity to have more than half a million men under arms as a professional paid standing army is monumental, right? Even though the quality of that force might be varied or be at a lower sort of mean standard, it's still quite an accomplishment for the Romans to field this force for, you know, the better part of two centuries. It's quite a miracle if you think about it. But going back to the question that you've asked, I think the Germans realize that in order to make an impression upon the Romans, they have to attack in greater numbers, which means that the Germans kind of have to put aside whatever differences they might have, or that, you know, for their own advantageous goals, they have to sort of coalesce in larger groups to be more of a threat to Rome, to be able to penetrate the frontiers. And then once they get into these cities, they can pillage them. They can ravage the countryside.
This is what I mean when I say that they learn, it's not just the Romans learning, right? It's the Germans.
Yeah. I would argue the Germans are learning more than the Romans at this point. To be fair,
I mean, I suppose the Romans can't learn much apart from how to,
and also the technological gap, I think, does decrease in this time as well. I think the Germans, having had this sort of contact with the Romans for a couple of centuries, adapt a lot of the advances, or to some degree, some of the advances that the Romans have made and incorporate into their own, whether it's metallurgy, whether it's masonry, whatever, sciences applied to militaristic science and applied and sort of incorporate with their own, you might say, German way of war and their own ethos regarding warfare and fighting, which, as we know from things that, Tacitus wrote about, the Gauls and the Germans, this attitude really doesn't change among the Germans. And they take on this offensive posture and they start sort of quite literally, like a vulture or a crow, they start sort of picking away at this sort of decaying empire, which is Rome.
And we see just little chips being taken off. I mean, Aurelian, who we mentioned, who reconquered the east and the west, and he repelled another invasion of the Goths. But then Dacia, the province, finally lost. It was abandoned.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. To maintain and it anymore. By the year, Mike, you just.
Well, you got to think too. Aurelian actually intercepts, I believe, is Alamein, the river Lake Garda. And for those who don't know, Lake Garda is in Rome. It's actually in the proximity of the Po Valley, and it's the furthest.
Yes, Germans this is the Aurelian walls, right? They were built at this time, of course.
Well, yeah. Well, I don't know if you or AM have ever been to Rome. I've had the fortune of going a couple times. I have family not far from the city, And the Aurelian walls are still there in relatively good condition. They're quite imposing. And Aurelian is compelled to build them because the Alemanni, not only are they the first German tribes to actually venture through the Swiss Alps, they actually enter Italy. And like I just said before, Aurelian ambushes them at Lake Garda, which is just in the north of Italy. It's in the Po Valley. And so there's this fear that hits Rome for the first time that there's actually a very clear and present danger of being vulnerable to the old, ferocious, gargantuan enemy that are these, German barbarian people. They're back with a vengeance.
Yeah. I mean, and after this point, I mean, the amount of wars and incursions and raids and counter raids gets a bit impossible to track. I mean, I know that Constantine won a great victory against, even captured like a king.
Well, several. Constantine, if you take his probably civil wars out of the equation just for a second, Constantine is probably arguably one of the, in the latter life of the Roman Empire, probably is one of the most successful emperor generals against the tribes north of the Danube.
Definitely, yeah. Yeah, I mean, he wins multiple victories against the Goths and the Alemanni, but it just becomes such a drain on resources and an impossible situation to maintain.
Yeah. Which I know this stream is more about the Germans than the Romans, so I don't want to hark on about it, but it in a nutshell, it compels the Romans, under Diocletian, to set up the Tetrarchy. Diocletian attempts to sort of set prices in the economy, which doesn't work. It stimulates the whole black market. The Roman currency really starts to collapse through the 3rd century because there's such a strain on taxes to maintain this Roman army that has essentially been doubled in size, when the Roman economy certainly has not doubled in size and neither the tax base. And they have all these sort of these concurrent circumstances and this coalescing of various influences and various events happening at once that really strike Rome at a period of profound vulnerability. And meanwhile, too, you've got to think in the East, the Parthians have been sort of usurped by a dynasty from Persis in Persia. You have the Sassanids come to forth, and the Sassanids are a far more aggressively postured eastern neighbor than what the Parthians were. So this is all sort of happening at once.
Yeah. And then Constantine's around 300, right?
Thereabouts, yes. Because Decius dies in 251? And Constantine becomes emperor. I'm trying to think what year. I've just literally had a blank. But yes, you're talking early 300s, yeah.
Because I'm trying to think, I would say the next major major migration and major push into the empire is probably caused by the Huns, right?
Yeah.
And I think I have to stop you there because we're moving in. Okay, my computer is going to make a noise, but people are just going to have to tolerate it.
Okay.
we're Yes, we're moving into next stream, but I think I would like to posit the question to you, which is what about the latent Christianization of the Goths before we get into the Great Migrations as a kind of a stream capper, as it were?
I honestly couldn't tell you a lot about the Christianization. I really couldn't. It's not my area. I assume we had a couple of miracles, though. I will tell you that.
I'll just summarize very quickly before my computer blows up. When we're talking about Constantine, obviously this is the natural launch point because Constantine, of course, introduces Christianity as a tolerated religion before it becomes the official religion under Theodosius. But the Christianization of the Goths is attributed to Orphalas in the 4th century, who was a Cappadocian Greek who was born into Gothic captivity. During this captivity, he would become proficient in Greek and Latin, and he would convert many of the Goths to Arian Christianity, Arianism, rejects the notion of Christ as co-eternal with the Father, as established in Nicene Christianity. Interestingly, though, Athanaric, the Gothic king of one of the Gothic tribes, the Thervingi, banished Orphalas, considering that Christianity, despite the fact that this was heathen Christianity, was a form of Roman subversion against the Goths. And back in the empire, he and a bunch of other scholars were able to devise the Gothic alphabet and presided over the creation of the Vulfila, which is another variation of Ulfilas's name, which will become the Gothic Bible. And the Vulfila is one of the best examples of the Gothic language and also one of the earliest documents of the Germanic language as a whole, which is why it's so significant, as opposed to all these myriad runic inscriptions we've had from previously. I think even though it's East Germanic, which is very much different language to what will evolve into medieval German, I think it's important to note that the Christianization and you could say the literary culture of the Goths will go hand in hand. And as you mentioned, the rise of the Goths also goes in hand with the early dismembering of the empire because Dacia has been abandoned and they more or less occupy that province.
They become such firm friends in many ways of the Romans. I mean, it's Aetius and the Goths against Attila and the Huns.
Yes, yes, at the Battle of the Catalonian Plains.
Mm. Are we going to touch on Adrianople, or are we going to leave that for next time?
Sorry, computer.
Not all good.
Yes, Adrianople, obviously, sorry, people, the noise. Adrianople will be next time. I think that's a good place to start for our conversation when it comes to the Great Migrations. I'd like you two to give us your closing remarks, and I'll come back later and quickly sum up the Super Chats, if that's all right.
Okay. Marcus, after you.
I don't really have a lot else to really say. I think we sort of canvassed most of what was important. I think what can be said, though, sort of in reflection of this discussion we've had about the Germans, is that the Germans proved to be one of the sort of the first obstacles that the Romans confront and don't actually vanquish. And if you consider who the Romans were and the obstacles they themselves confronted, I mean, this is little swamp town in the Tiber Valley. City-state that becomes master of Italy, then becomes master of the Western Mediterranean. It conquers and vanquishes Gaul. It marches its way through Greece and the Diadochi. It vanquishes the descendants of Alexander. It conconquers Gaul. It crosses the Rhine and does to some degree humble the Germans. It conquers most of Britannia. It's an empire that's from its very humble origins. It's an empire that spans from the Atlantic to the Caspian Sea, from the largest extent the Red Sea to the North Sea, from the Rhine River down to the Sahara, the Danube to the Sahara, and yet the German people, the German tribes, stay out of the Roman sphere, and moreover, it's the Germans who, to some degree, become the sort of the great calamity that collapses certainly the west half of the empire. And for anyone who actually is interested in this, the concept of the strategy of the Roman Empire, if I can recommend one author to you, it would be Edward Luttwak. He actually wrote the Grand Strategy of the Roman Empire, and he also then wrote the Grand Strategy of the Byzantine Empire. And there's a fantastic interview of him, and I can't remember if it's at Harvard or it's University of California. He does like some hour-long talk about his book, about the Byzantine Strategy book. And you know, he basically posits this point that if you look at the empire at its greatest extent, or certainly at its largest extent as a single unified empire, you know, you look at the fact that in the West, there's all this defense in depth, right? You have Gaul that is guarded by the Rhine. You know, Gaul can only be attacked really from the east through Germania. You know, in Italy, they can always retreat to the Alps, and Italy itself is a defensive peninsula because it's narrow and long, you know, as the Allies found to their distress in the Second World War when Churchill famously said it's the soft underbelly of Europe, and they found out quite to their discomfort that it wasn't. You know, there's all this sort of defensive structure that's there, and yet for a whole bunch of other reasons, right, that aren't geographical, the West collapses. The West is sort of, you know, overcome by this human wave of migration of, you know, of the Ostrogoths and the Visigoths and the Suevi and the Vandals and the Burgundians, the Angles and Saxons, etc., right? Yet the East, which can actually be attacked from all sides and quite literally only has the Danube and the Taurus Mountains as defensive geographical, you know, natural borders as such, right? It's got this massive exposed frontier along the Syrian desert, you know. I mean, there was never great threats from Africa, but Africa itself could have been vulnerable under different circumstances. It could always be attacked from the north, you know, from the Great Eurasian Steppe, you know, through the Crimea, through the, you know, the Don-Volga rivers, through the Caucasus, through, you know, across the Danube, as happened several times. It's funny, we're going to touch on Adrianople tomorrow, so I don't want to say too much about it, but, you know, we talk about how Adrianople's the death knell of the empire, but it happens in the Eastern Empire, not the Western Empire, yet it's the Western Empire that falls. So the Germans have this really crucial, critical role in this destruction of the Western Empire, and I guess we'll get to that next week, but it's a very interesting sort of a position to leave us at, that the Germans are the first people to resist Rome successfully and also play a very critical role in the eventual collapse of West Rome.
Yeah, and of course we'll get there, but this is with the beginning of these mass movements and then the establishment of these peoples, we see the building blocks, the seeds being planted for Europe's aristocracy and the history of European aristocracy, which Evola actually writes beautifully on. But apart from that, I don't have any comments there. Do we have super chats? Do we have anything
absolutely.
Like that?
Thank you, Marcus. That was a wonderful summary, by the way, just illustrating how significant and, you know, the irony of the tribe again being first able to seriously, you know, give the Rome a bloody nose, and again comes back to ultimately lead to its demise, at least in the West. Yes, we'll get to super chats if that's all right. Chris O'Hanlon has given £5. That's very kind of you, Chris O'Hanlon. Everything counts. Judge Caligula Bushman for £2, a small donation for the new computer for AM Fund.
man.
Thank you very much.
One for the team. Thanks, buddy.
And Lord Megatron for £10, a little later than the period covered. The most beautiful Germanic language is Middle English. It is superior to modern English by a country mile, Chaucer.
I've been reading Chaucer recently. Absolutely beautiful. He's surprisingly bawdy in his verses, though. He literally talks about grabbing women by the pussy, which thought was really funny, but not exactly the kind of thing you'd imagine being read in front of knights and ladies, but very funny.
Yes, and again, that's just a nice little iteration. You know, sadly, we're not going to be able to do an England stream. Otherwise, you know, if we were to do England as well, combined with this, we will never get to the end of this series.
Yeah, we'll die of old age first.
So we have to make some limitations. But thank you very much for those super chats. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Before we go, Marcus, is there anything you want to show?
No, I'm just a humble guest here. As you did last week, you kindly put my Twitter handle there. So if anyone wants to sort of follow and, appreciate little snippets of some of the, you know, thoughts I have, feel free to just follow. But otherwise, you know, I'm just here to share my knowledge and have fun. And hope you guys had fun listening. And again, AM and Columba has been a privilege, and I've had a lot of fun. I really appreciated being invited despite some technical difficulties. I don't know if the chat knows, but I had some difficulties here in the colony in Australia, so I had to improvise with a secondary microphone. So I appreciate everybody's patience. It was aside from my steam powered internet being slow at the best of times, I had to improvise a bit tonight. So my apologies to everyone, but thank you for your patience, and it's been a privilege. Thank you.
Wonderful. And thank you very much again for coming on, Marcus. Columba.
Well, I want to do this. I really want to plan out some of flesh out some more stuff about Richard III, because we were talking privately about possibly doing an episode of Heterodox History on Richard III. But I don't know. I might write an article on him for my Substack, because thank God my personal circumstances, I'm a bit more free now. Work's been a bit less stressful, so I'll have more time to write. And Richard III has always been a fascinating one for me, so I might put something out about him in the next couple of weeks. Apart from that, nothing, apart from the regular vituperous tweeting, but that's par for the course.
Yeah, and we'll look forward to seeing that if you're able to finish that. There's a last minute super chat by Endorphin Junkie for $5. Was there punishment for any of Varys's family for the Teutoburg disaster?
I think his son was disgraced. I don't think he was actively punished, but his name was associated with ill omen. He certainly was never given a command. And so the family line pretty much died out in terms of distinction. Yeah, which is a punishment, I suppose, right?
And there's also something to be said too, as well, that the disaster. I actually didn't get to use the phrase earlier, but this event had such a profound effect on the Romans that they essentially called it Clades Variana, which means the Varian disaster. And what it did have is, and it's happened to a number over the times. You could say the same thing happened to Manuel after the Battle of Myriokephalon of the Comnenian dynasty, much, much further down the line, that these catastrophic defeats end up almost crippling the ruler. And Augustus is never the same again. And the writers even reference his physical decline. He stoops lower, he wears simple clothes, he sleeps on a soldier's bed, his teeth actually fall out, and whether that's just natural course or whether he's actually accelerated by a genuine grief from the disaster, we'll never know, but it's an interesting thing to observe. So is a man like that probably is in a position where he wants to reprimand the family for it. I just don't think Augustus was of the mind, to be honest, but that's just my personal perspective.
No, well, very interesting. If you like this stream, do like and leave a comment. If you really like this content, consider signing up to my Subscribestar account, which is linked in the description. Thanks again to the guests for being stellar this evening, and thank you again, everyone, for watching, and good night.